From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Mia Love lost to Congressman Jim Matheson in 2012 by 768 votes. Close, respectable, but as the writers of a new book about Love point out, it wasn't supposed to end like that. The Utah legislature had practically designed the congressional district for a Republican candidate. She had gotten the endorsement from Mitt Romney. She had drawn attention and money from the National Party because of her story. As the book puts it, the Love campaign enjoyed a hurricane force tailwind. The book explores why she lost and why she won this year. So it's a political story, but it's also a biography about Love's personal life and her emergence as a national figure. So we're talking about the Mia Love story today, and we invite you to join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Let's admit it, it's a risk to commit yourself to writing a book about someone when you're not entirely sure of the outcome of the most critical part of the story. At some point, and we're going to find out here soon, Matt Canham, Robert Gerke, and Thomas Burr, reporters at the Salt Lake Tribune, decided to write a kind of biography of Mia Love. Love won the race for the 4th Congressional District earlier this month, but the contest once again came down to the wire. Of course, she lost in 2012 at a time when she seemed to have everything going for her, so there is that theme, political reemergence. And there's also a very interesting personal backstory here, one that you're pretty familiar with by now. The daughter of Haitian immigrants converts to Mormonism, makes her way to Utah County, becomes mayor of a small town. But Mia Love is far from being a fully formed figure, so again, it's risky to write a book about her. So today in the program, we're going to ask why. We'll talk about it. Matt Canham is joining us, an investigative reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. Matt, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Robert Gerke covers politics and government. He's joining us here in the studio. Welcome back.
Good morning, Doug.
And Thomas Burr, the Tribune's correspondent in Washington, D.C., is joining us from the studios of NPR in Washington there. And Thomas Burr, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
So let me mention the name of the book, by the way, Mia Love, The Rise, Stumble, and Resurgence of the Next GOP Star. So I wanted to get a few questions about ethics out of the way here first. There wasn't any kind of formal complaint made with a local chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists, but a few questions were raised, and I want to have you address them here early on. Cheryl Worsley is the news director at KSL. Now, she's clarified that she wasn't speaking for KSL, but she did just raise some questions. And they're out there, and I wanted to give you a chance to respond. If you are reporters covering a candidate, should you disclose to the public that you're writing a book about a particular candidate during the campaign?
Well, no, I don't feel like we approach it any differently. We're still journalists reporting on a candidate, interviewing people about the candidate. The work we were doing, if it was news that was relevant and pertinent to the campaign that might influence the way voters, you know, make up their minds, we had said up front that we were going to put that in the newspaper. We didn't withhold anything that would have been pertinent to the campaign or the election itself. So we were journalists. That's how we approached it. And you know, there are people who are questioning, well, did you go easy on her? Did you go after Doug Owens? I'd challenge those people to point to anything in the record that would indicate that we did. And we haven't heard any complaints from, you know, Doug Owens' campaign about the coverage he received. We did actually hear some complaints from the Mia Love campaign that thought we were going after them too aggressively. So I think, while that's a fair question to ask, it's certainly something that's worthy of discussion. I would challenge any of those people to point to anything in actual fact that would indicate that there was any hijinks here, and it's just not the case. So we covered Mia Love's 2012 campaign and her 2014 campaign thoroughly and fairly and aggressively, and that put us, I think, in a unique position to actually tell this story in a way that others might not be able to.
I think there's a couple other points to be made here. First is the people who raise these questions, which while we said is legitimate at a starting point, they didn't read the book. And since they've raised these questions, we haven't heard that they have read the book. And we haven't heard anyone who actually has read the book say, here's something that should have been in the newspaper before it was in your book. Here's where you went soft. It's an accusation. Now, as you said, the question is, should we, go down this path? And I think that we should talk about that for a second, too. You know, you said it is risky to write a book about someone, and I completely agree. But few people have the backup plan that we had. We're political reporters for the Salt Lake Tribune. It's a very small shift to take all the work we did for this and turn it into a series for the newspaper.
But the question did come up. What would have happened to the project if Mia Love had lost? I mean, would you still have gone forward with a book, do you think?
Well, see, and that actually, we don't have an answer to that question, honest with you. So when we started this out, we said, we want to try some long-form journalism in a way we haven't done before. Her story fits the bill. And it would fit the bill whether she won or lost in a longer narrative format. Whether that would have been in an ebook or whether that would have been in a series of newspaper stories, the editors of the Salt Lake Tribune never made that decision because we didn't have to because of the way the election turned out. But I will tell you how I approached Mia Love when we first started this project.
Yeah.
I sat down with her, said that, just what I said, that her story is interesting enough that it's bigger than one newspaper story. It has enough moving pieces that we thought it could be told in a large narrative. And I said, we're going to write this story whether you help us or not. And we're going to write this story whether you win or lose. That can't be the focal point. And we're political reporters. We can't let any story get in the way of us doing our job covering an election. And we didn't in this case.
We should also say you granted some sources anonymity to get some behind-the-scenes details, as you put it in your book, without exposing them to political backlash.
Right.
And that's a pretty standard practice, I think, for journalists, political journalists especially, and also, in the book, it gave us, we felt like we had a little bit more latitude to sort of exercise that, and I think the product was that you get a good feel of actually what's going on behind the scenes that otherwise people might not have been as forthcoming with if we hadn't had that at our disposal.
I will say on this one,
yeah,
I'm stunned by how many people were on the record. If you look at this and you hear what her friends say about her and what people involved in these campaigns are willing to say to us, it's amazing what we got on the record. And I will say, beyond just the anonymity, there were a couple times where we said, if it's specifically if it was strategy, then we'll wait till after the election. Mm-hmm. And I felt comfortable doing that because in a normal political, race, what we're writing about and how we focus on the news stories is, does this information help a voter make a decision about this contest? That's the threshold. Nothing in that book, met that threshold that didn't already appear in the paper.
Tommy Burr, let me ask you, to the Matt's, you raised that question, which I think is a good one, of why, what is it about Mia Love exactly that made you want to write this? I mean, there's the historic part of this, first black woman Republican elected to Congress, that's obvious. But what else? Is there something else that makes her a compelling figure? Because I think it becomes fairly clear in this that she's just beginning to emerge as any kind of a political figure. There's some reason to think she may stumble. She may not have it. So I mean, did you see the potential for her to be a national figure, or did that really matter to you when you decided to write the book?
Being a historical figure is a main part of that, but also her background is a very interesting thing. She's a unique character in Utah politics, unlike we've really ever seen. And I'll give you a good example of in some ways we've already been proven right in looking at her as a possible, big star in the GOP. One of the first things that happened when she got elected, she came back to Washington, and they team up new members with some veteran members. Usually they're not, big headline names, but Mia Love was teamed up with Paul Ryan, who of course was the 2012 vice presidential candidate for the Republican Party. He's going to be the chairman of the House Ways and Means. That's not somebody usually who's given to, a new member to show them the ropes. They may see something in her already that we also saw in writing the book. And let me just, add to
what?
The fact
what that, was that? What did you see in her? before you move
what,
on.
What did we see in it?
Yeah.
I think we saw that...
charisma or what?
Here's somebody beyond, you know, the fact of her race and gender that to make her, you know, a different person in the Republican Party.
Yeah.
The idea that she came, she's a first-generation American, the first person to, help her family get documented to be American citizens. She converted the Mormon faith. She moved across the country. She gets involved in politics after being apolitical for most of her life because of a little bug that was bothering her neighborhood in Saratoga Springs. Mm-hmm. A lot of interesting things that make you want to read and want to know more. And she kind of sketched out some of that in her campaign material. I'm sure your listeners remember, you know, she'd say things about her parents when they came here. She'd say things about being a small town mayor. But we wanted to flesh that out. What more is there beyond just the kind of skeleton biographical information she gave voters?
Well, and I would add, too, that in 2012, there were, 500 candidates roughly running for office, right? Not a lot of them got to speak at the Republican National Convention. I mean, I think it's clear that the party sees her as somebody who they're going to be putting in the spotlight, and she is going to be a national figure, in part because of her race and her gender and her politics.
You know what's interesting, though, about that? And you point this out in your book, the Republican National Committee, when they first read the speech mm-hmm. that they had offered in 2012 that she was supposed to deliver to this national audience, they hated it.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and is it because she, and I think this may get to a paradox that I think is pretty important for you to talk about, and mm-hmm. that is, how much of that does she realize is part of the sort of the novelty of the fact that she has this backstory, that right. she's first Black Republican to get on the stage. She seems ambivalent about that on some level, but she also seems to realize that is part of the appeal.
I think that's true. I think you hit it on the head. I think there's this sort of tension in her she's gained great benefit in her political career because of her race and her gender, but she's also apprehensive about sort of embracing that as sort of a defining characteristic, I think. You mentioned the Republican National Convention, the speech that they sent to her to give. They didn't like it because it didn't play to that her diversity enough. They said anybody could have walked out on stage and given that speech. They felt like she was just going to be the face and not deliver a message. And so it's actually kind of an interesting story. She prepared this entire 4.5-minute speech that departed drastically from the text that they had given her, and she was determined that she was going to give that speech at the convention, and so when they were running through the rehearsal,
she'd go off
the speech, she went off the teleprompter, and everybody's like, wait, what are you doing here? And one of the guys happened to say, well, you know, let's hear her out, let's see what she has to, you know, let's hear this thing. And so she gave the 4.5-minute speech from memory, and the guy that was timing her, you know, who as he was described had been in every convention since the Whig Party, said, you know, if you don't let her give every single word of that speech, you guys are blankety blank idiots. She's kind of had this ongoing tension with you know, not wanting to be defined solely as a Black Republican woman, but I think clearly it's a big part of who she is. And there was somebody who said in the book that when on her first trip to D.C., you know, she didn't have to open her mouth. She walked in her room and everybody started handing her checks for $5,000 because she was the one that the party wanted to come out of this nominating fight she was in and to be the next congresswoman from the 4th District.
One of the things that makes me love, I think, difficult to measure is how guarded she has been right. with the media. Matt Canham, talk to me a little bit about that. I mean, you know, we've had difficulty, to be honest, getting her on the program. She had resisted doing very many debates. She ended up doing one televised debate, although she was also on KSL
with Doug Wright.
How much of that is her? How much of that is the campaign saying we're afraid she's going to say something, she may not be ready for it? I mean, can you tell?
She was very risk adverse in this last election, and I think that had more to do with the campaign. I mean, you pointed it out in the open, she lost in 2012 by 768 votes. That's a number that's seared into her brain.
Yeah.
And she would bring it up often. And in that case, she did not want to put anything to chance. And so when she was seen as a front runner, she didn't want to make a mistake. So she limited opportunities to make mistakes. And that meant, you know, she did a lot of public events.
Are you saying she or they?
Well, they, but it's still, when you're a candidate, is it both, your decision.
Though?
I mean, I think yes, it is both. It is both. It wasn't like that she bucked her campaign the whole time and there was a fight, an internal fight. No, they gave her advice and she accepted that advice. But she did have a lot of public events. They were just small. She didn't make it easy for media to know when they were.
She wanted to be in control.
She wanted to be in control of those events. And that's why it was hard for us to get her to talk to us. You know, we spent weeks badgering them to give us interviews and to access to her family, and to the point where we just said, okay, well, we're going to fly to Connecticut. I really hope your dad doesn't slam the door in my face.
Really?
I ended up sitting outside his house for 3 hours one night, and he never showed up. I don't have his phone number. I don't have a way to contact him. It wasn't like they made this easy. You know, this is when I said, we're going to write this with or without your help. And we were. That over time, we would get these interviews. But I will say that while we have a remarkable amount of detail, there's a part of her that she didn't show. There's a personal, emotional part that was impossible to tap into. When we asked how she felt about losing by 768 votes, the best we would get is, it was frustrating. Well, that goes without saying. Yeah. It was frustrating. But there's still a guardedness. She still has that struggle to say what I'm going to share and what I'm not.
What do you think she really feels to that? In the answer to that question? I mean, if you were to really...
How it felt?
Yeah, 768. She was a shoo-in.
She was very surprised. She was hurt.
Yeah.
What I think in what our book talks about is how fast she got back on the horse. You know, it's not surprising that she ran again.
Yeah.
She started running again.
In December,
yeah. After the November election, right. Like she already started getting a campaign team together. That kind of mental shift shows that at least it wasn't crushing. No one who's crushed and depressed moves that fast. But it goes without saying that it was very painful.
I want to get to that backstory that you really dig into here in the book when we get back from a break. Matt Canham is with us, an investigative reporter for the paper. Robert Gerke covers politics and government for the Trib. Tommy Burr is in Washington, D.C., the Salt Lake Tribune's correspondent there. They've written a book about Congresswoman-elect Mia Love. It's called Mia Love, The Rise, Stumble, and Resurgence of the Next GOP Star. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking with three reporters with the Salt Lake Tribune who've written a book, a biography of sorts, of Mia Love. Mia Love, the rise, the stumble, and resurgence of the next GOP star. I'm stumbling all over that. Sorry about that. We'll talk about all of those things, by the way, the rise, the stumble, the resurgence. Matt Canham, Robert Gerke, and Tommy Burr are with us. So you did eventually talk... her father.
With her father, yes.
Into speak. How did that work? He finally said, okay, I'll talk to you for a minute?
Well, let me explain a little bit of a backstory about 2012. We wanted to do a profile of her, obviously much shorter than this, at that time. And her parents are a cornerstone of her campaign.
Yep.
She brings up that she is the daughter of Haitian immigrants in every public appearance I have ever seen. And yet they've never talked.
But you also say this, let me quote this from your book, that she's deeply uncomfortable with reporters talking to her parents.
Yes, I think she's protective. She's also worried. You know, and in the last election, you know, it was an issue of whether her birth helped her parents become citizens or not. And as I said before, she was risk averse in this campaign. She did not want them to say anything that would be an issue. Now, in 2012... we wanted to talk to her parents. She said no. She said no. She said no. So finally, I went to Connecticut, and I sat outside his house until he showed up from work, and I talked to him in his driveway for 15 minutes. And what I found was someone who was gregarious and intelligent and engaging and very proud of his daughter. You know, he was a father. And he said really interesting things. And he also said... Well, yeah, her birth did help us become citizens. which, you know, goes to the point of the story. And we used that in that story. So yeah. He had seen me before. But this time, I wanted more. I wanted to know about his life in Haiti and what impact that had on how he raised his daughter and how he saw America. And I kept bugging. They said no. Finally, I said, I'm booking a flight, and I really hope you don't, you know, that he's willing to talk to me. They didn't set a time. They didn't give me his phone number. I just showed up. And luckily, he was sitting outside his house reading his Freemason handbook, which I think he's read about 9 million times.
Yeah, he's very proud Freemason.
Very small book, well-worn. And he has a French magazine sitting next to him. So he speaks, obviously, three languages. He speaks Creole, French, and English. And he was really great at talking to me. What I found is that his thick accent did create a little bit of a barrier. I'd ask a question. He thought I was asking a different question. He'd answer. I thought he was answering a different thing. And so it meant that a 2 or 3 hour interview was really like an hour interview. But he was more open than before. The one thing he wasn't open about was his immigration. It was very clear that they decided that they weren't going to say anything more about it. They were going to just defer or say they didn't know and let it be what it is.
You say the family declined when asked to petition the federal government for the release of their immigration file.
Right. So he kept saying, I don't know. I just signed whatever document they put in front of me. I hired an attorney. That was their job to figure out how we became citizens. It was far different from the detail we've had in previous interviews, where it sure sounds like they knew. And so I said, well, the best way to do this is just to get the actual file. The way it works is no one can get someone else's immigration file without their permission. He has to sign a document releasing that to us, and they declined to do so.
Yeah. So talk about Maxime, right?
Yes.
Bordeaux, born into a family, you say, upper middle class. He was born into privilege, I think, relatively speaking.
Well, for Haiti standards, yes. Significant privilege. His parents owned and operated a plantation. Their children did not work the plantation. They had staff for that. Their children actually lived in a city called Jeremy, outside of where this plantation was, and he was able to go to school. And while the Constitution in Haiti says everyone gets to go to school, the reality is far different from that. He had an upper-middle-class life. He had summer vacations, and this is a country that is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, where people live on just a couple dollars a day, and that was not his experience. And so this all happened, but his family's wealth started to erode and decline because this country was run by dictators.
Yeah, by Baby Doc.
Right. Yeah, and these people, and his father, Papa Doc, Doc Duvalier and Baby Doc Duvalier kept saying they were going to help people. And what they ended up doing was demolish property owners' rights and give parcels to poorer people, which meant plantation owners were hurt by this. They also had a swine flu. They had to kill every Creole pig. They replaced them with American pigs. Now, the difference is significant. Creole pigs, you don't need special feed to feed them. They just live on what naturally is produced in Haiti, and they are much bigger and produce more meat. You put in an American pig, a little pink pig, they got to pay special food. So all the stuff, his family's wealth eroded. But also, just because his parents had wealth does not mean he had that access. He couldn't get a job. He moved to Port-au-Prince after some very scary things that happened in Jeremy, where his friends got slaughtered when the government shut down a coup and decided to blame every member of those people's families that killed hundreds of people in his town, including some of his friends, who had nothing to do with the coup. They just happened to have the wrong last name. They were worried that any young adult, especially young male, would be threatened by that. So they sent their son to Port-au-Prince, and he was there for 7 years. He never found a job.
Yeah. Got an occasional part-time thing at a theater or something from time to time.
And it was just, he just sat around. And that was totally commonplace for men of his age. That's why they wanted to come to the United States. He wanted to provide for his family. His parents' wealth was starting to erode. So that's part of the reason they immigrated.
His father met his mother, Marie, who didn't speak to you. She was working at a Catholic school when he met her. It was quite a process they had to go through to court her because she ended up living with her uncle, who was a priest, who kept a pretty close eye.
Very close eye. So she was the only daughter in the family, and she had a bunch of brothers. So you have her uncle, who's the priest, the patriarch of the family. Her father is still in the picture. He's around every day. Then you got all her brothers. For any guy who was going to get close to Marie, it was going to be a task. You know, his actual background helped in that he came from plantation owners. He came from a well-established family. But he also had to start working to show his support. So every Sunday he could go to Mass with the family, stay there till 9, and promptly at 9 he was escorted out of the house. And it also shows the role that the Catholic Church played in this family. They were not just cafeteria right. Catholics. They were Catholic. They went to church constantly. The person who ran their household was a priest.
You know what's great, though, about it, and interesting anyway, is when Mila ultimately reveals to her uncle that she became a Mormon, he was kind of okay with it.
You know, yeah, there was a respect level of, you know, well, Mormons are good people.
Yeah.
But her parents had a much harder time with the conversion of both her sister and herself. Her sister converted before she did.
Right.
And her sister was, you know, like a lot of converts are, very excited about their new faith. And she would plant Books of Mormon around the house, hoping just that someone might pick it up and read it. She kept inviting missionaries open, just hoping someone might have a conversation. And she ended up, you know, her sister ended up taking her up on it. No one else in the family did. They're all still proud Catholics.
Well, and you tell a great story in the book, too, about the about how her parents sent Mia to church with her sister to kind of be a spy and report back on what Cindy's doing.
Right. And what happened, it was Fast Sunday, where the Mormons will get up and talk about their testimony in very personal and emotional terms, and they often cry. And this is Mia's first time there.
And she's freaked out.
And she's freaked out. All these people are getting up and crying. And she doesn't know what's going on. And then afterward, her sister says that she's got a calling to work in the nursery with the children. And so she says, okay.
And she's going to be set apart.
And she's going to be set apart.
Which requires like laying on of hands.
Right. Yeah, and so there's all these words that she doesn't understand. And so so the branch president pulls her into a room, her sister into a room to set her apart. And Mia misinterprets everything and panic calls her mom saying, there are people crying, saying that spirits are touching them, and I don't understand what's going on. And God is talking to Cindy, saying that she has to work with kids. And they're put into a room to take her apart. They are taking her apart, and she seems to be okay. And so her mom tells her to get in there. So she bursts into the room when they're having this very, you know,
solemn
religious ceremony with, you know, they place her hands on her head and say a prayer. And they look at her with, you know, total befuddlement, which I think is fascinating, is both her sister and Mia had awkward first encounters with the Mormon Church. Yeah. That, you know, everyone who her sister Cindy talked to about the Mormon Church said, they're all polygamists and it's a cult where they're trying to take some spaceship to heaven, which is never true. That never has happened. The polygamist thing has happened, but
that's past.
That's 100 years ago. So, and then they went, and it was an awkward first encounter for her, too. She didn't understand what was going on. She didn't really jive, but she kept going. And I think it's fascinating how hungry both of them were for something in their life to fill that role, that even though the first time didn't go so well, they went, well, we'll go again and see how it goes.
You know, it's interesting. I wanted to ask you about Maxime. So they end up in Connecticut eventually. I mean,
right.
They live in Brooklyn for a brief time. Mia doesn't remember much of that. They end up going to Norwalk, Connecticut, and they make this transition to this American life. And I wondered, what were the expectations for Maxime and Marie of their kids? Because you say Maxime wanted all of his kids to go to college, seems to have created a pretty rigorous routine for them.
Right.
And I wondered, give me a sense of what influence you think that may have had on her political awakening later. Do you see any connection in any of that? I mean, her father, you point out in the book, resisted any reliance on the government, or very much reliance anyway
right.
on the government.
I mean, he would get unemployment benefits.
Right.
There's certain things that he was okay with, but he didn't. I mean, one, he had a distrust of government. He came from a place where the government was a dictator and
right.
they did bad things,
yeah.
you know? So there you have that. I mean, when he immigrated, he was in his 30s. He was a pretty well-established adult. So the way he saw the world was formed. And so he didn't want to trust the government. He didn't want his kids reliant on the government. He wanted his kids self-reliant. And a part of that, I think, is a reaction to his childhood and his young adult years, where he couldn't get work. He wanted to be self-reliant and couldn't in his country. America gave him the ability to be self-reliant, and he wanted his kids to have that. And so he was very, very protective. He also told me that in his country, when you screw up as a kid, it can ruin your life. If you're caught shoplifting as a child, you don't get a second chance. You're then branded forever as a thief. And he was very worried about that. He did not want his children to play with children who could be a bad influence. He would bus them to the better schools. He would, you know, he would bus them. He never bus them. He always drove, and he was very proud of that. He actually ended up being a bus driver, which is kind of ironic. But anyway, he would drive them to the good neighborhoods so they could play. And
what, dictated who they could play
and
with.
Dictated and, who they could play yeah. with. And if they were going to have a sleepover, it was going to be in his house. But what this also did is it showed his kids, it reminded them of their socioeconomic class in a way that I think a lot of children don't actually know. I mean, you could be a poor children, but if you're all playing in the neighborhood, you don't even realize you're poor. Mia Love and her siblings realized they were poor because they were driven to the nicer neighborhoods, told to play with the nicer or the kids with more money. And when those kids wanted to come to their house, sometimes their parents would say, yeah, I'm not sending my kid to the rough part of town. And so it was constant reminder that they didn't have a lot of money. I think that, you know, it's hard to, you know, to say anything but that those experiences would influence the way that Mia Love saw the world, and that self-reliance, that distrust of government, you know.
This is interesting, too, though. Maxime's first vote that he casts is for Ronald Reagan.
Right.
But he also votes for Barack Obama.
He is super proud of his votes for Barack Obama.
I think it's interesting that Mia Love also considered voting for Barack Obama.
Right, which is, I don't think is well known. You know, after Barack Obama got the Democratic nomination, she was very high on that moment. She talked about the significance to this country that a black man got a presidential nomination of a major party, that he was an inspiring figure and someone that she was going to teach her children about because he represented that they could be anything.
And I think what's interesting about that is that he didn't seem to be saying, we're Republicans here. That Maxime wasn't saying that to
his
kids. No,
he wasn't. He actually was saying we were Democrats when they were younger. Because he is very politically active. If you talk to Maxime today, he could tell you about what's happening politically in the United States and in Haiti and in France and in Uganda and probably many other places. He devours news and is a very smart man when it comes to this stuff. And it's a remarkable memory. His children didn't get this. I don't know how that didn't translate, but it did not translate. They were not engaged at a young age in politics. And I think what you saw is that, you know, that came later in life to Mia. And, you know, his influence, though, is heavy in so many other ways in how she saw the world, how she saw what was expected of her and her husband and family. I think that's, you know, it's hard to overstate his influence in her life.
We're going to take a break here, and then we're going to get to the more of the political dimensions of Mia Love's story. Matt Canham with us, investigative reporter. Robert Gerke and Tommy Burr also with us. Robert, of course, covers politics and government. Tommy Burr is the Tribune's correspondent in Washington, D.C. Their book is called Mia Love, The Rise, Stumble, and Resurgence of the Next GOP Star. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us Matt Canham, Robert Gerke, and Tommy Burr. They're reporters with the Salt Lake Tribune. They've written a book about Mia Love. It's called Mia Love, The Rise, Stumble, and Resurgence of the Next GOP Star. One of the things we were talking about off the air, and I wanted you to say something about this as we sort of head into the political phase of her life, is she's pretty much stayed out of the political conversations at home. She wasn't interested in that. The thing that she connected with her father in particular, was music.
Right.
And this is the dimension that I wanted you to talk about, the performance part, because that's also important and instructive, I suppose, in her political life.
Yeah. So when her father talked about politics, she wasn't interested. When her father got the band together in the basement and they played Haitian music, she was all about that. The idea of performing, she just liked to move. She liked music. She gets to school, and she ends up going into the theater program. She goes to college, and she becomes a musical theater major. And she was pretty good at it. She was the star of the senior production at a school 40 miles from Broadway. You know, this was her thing. And what happens is in her transition into politics, that's where she excels. There is a performance art to politics, to the delivery of a speech, to the interacting with a voter. She's great at that. And that's part of the reason Republican Party were so excited about her. Yeah. Not just the way she looks, but the way she can communicate. This is how she approaches politics. And even when you talk about what she wants to do now, she wants to be out in front. She wants to be delivering the message. I think one thing that both Robert and I found when we talked to her that was kind of interesting is before every big speech, she listens to some random classical music and, you know, goes into this Zen moment before she performs. And she got that from college and from the musical theater program.
One of the people I interviewed compared it to Kevin Garnett getting ready for a basketball game, has the headphones in and is just sort of goes off in her zone. But yeah, I mean, it's completely, she traded the Broadway spotlights, I think, for the political spotlight. And as Matt said, I mean, they're interchangeable in a lot of ways. I mean, she performs wonderfully on the big stage. She you know, we talked, there were highlights in the 2012 campaign, both at the state convention and at the national convention, where she put on a heck of a performance and it made her a viable candidate.
There were two elements that you say contributed to her political awakening. One was 9/11. Say something about that, if you would, because you say that those attacks on September 11th really crushed her emotionally and altered her view of the world.
Well, actually, when I talked to her about it, I was fascinated because it crushed everybody.
Yeah, of course.
It hurt everybody. But what was different is the way she responded to it was, I need to know more about this. I don't know enough to comprehend what happened to the United States. It was a moment where she said, it's time to do some homework. And because she wasn't politically engaged, she was a young mom who just moved to Utah. She converted to a new faith a few years before. Her focus was elsewhere.
And but so, it also was happening at a similar time when she was getting politically involved because of the midge, the little mosquito-like bug on Utah Lake near Saratoga Springs.
That well, her that's the other influence.
Trying to get her to come and do something about.
Yeah, say a little bit more about that, because she gets pissed off because of these bugs because she moves to the Utah Lake on the right there, and she gets really fired up about it. That's another part of her political. Tommy, you want to say more about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, so this is a new community. Of course, Saratoga Springs has grown up a lot in the last decade or so, but she's new to this area, and they can't even enjoy their outside space. There's this little black mosquito that just, you know, is clinging to every window and every surface outside, and you can't go have a barbecue. And her neighbors are getting upset about it. You know, and this is when Mia maybe kind of politically emerges and says, we need to, you know, take this to City Hall. And they take it to City Hall and they lose. And they take it to the developer. And they finally get the developer of the community to do something about it. And her neighbors are rallying around Mia, but they see her as you know, the figurehead of this movement. And people start seeing her as something more than just, Mia Love. She's got something in her that we like to see in politics. One, she actually got something done. And maybe that's the first spark. 9/11 comes along and she wants to be more educated. It really kind of marked her moving away from just being, somebody who's interested in theater and music and a mom into somebody who wants to actually run for office.
And her husband, Jason, grew up around politics. I mean, he was right. His dad ran for office actually
against the governor.
Is Utah County Commissioner. And so he was, you know, he'd put up lawn signs and stuff, and they kind of steer toward sort of the Sean Hannity regimen, I guess, of political education. And sort of that's sort of what started informing her political opinions, I think.
So she comes agnostic about politics mostly into that relationship. Is that fair to say? And then she gets influenced by her father-in-law, by her husband, by her neighbors in Utah County?
In the year 2000, which was before this, obviously, she voted for George W. Bush. Right. And it's the first vote she ever cast. And she considered herself Republican. But if you asked her why she was Republican at that moment, it would have been very vague and very philosophical. She didn't know, but she felt that Republicans were smaller government people. She would like smaller government. Therefore, she was Republican. These are the moments where she starts thinking, I want to be more involved. So you know, and what does that mean? And what does that mean for our world? And it starts to develop. But even then, we're talking on a pretty small level here. You know, her understanding of the politics nationally isn't great. You know, she starts getting involved in city government, and that's where her focus then turns.
What kind of mayor was she?
It was largely, the mayor of Saratoga Springs is not a very powerful position because they don't actually vote on any of the ordinances. And so it's kind of, they break ties. And she came in at a time when, obviously the economy was kind of crashing. Saratoga Springs was propped up entirely based on impact fees and building fees. And then when the building market bottomed out, you know, they were kind of left with this huge hole in the budget. So during that time, they were faced with having to either have this huge, I think, 400% property tax increase or try to cut back. And they did a little bit of both. And they ended up with a significant property tax increase of about 116% in the first year, and cut the budget some. But it was a challenge for her, and she kind of references it as, you know, we saw, I guess the need for government to be balanced, and you need to cut some, you need to, you know, she was hit during the 2012 campaign later over that big property tax increase. She was a tax and, you know, tax and cut conservative, I guess. But, you know, she said it was a difficult time for the city and for herself as mayor, and she kind of, I guess, a little bit of a baptism by fire as an executive. But it also, you know, it kind of, being elected to that position certainly gave her an elevated profile in politics. You know, people I talked to, who worked on her campaign or got behind her campaign, I'm like, what did you, you know, when did you first hear about Mia Love? And it's when she was elected mayor of Saratoga Springs. That was sort of her platform.
It was the fastest growing city in the state at the time. You know, this is an area that was farmland, and overnight there's, you know, 20,000 people that live there.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you, it seems like right around 2011, when people are starting to pay attention to this Mia Love character, seems like this is where you get to the part of the story where it begins to sound a bit like the Sarah Palin story on some level. There are those who are grooming Mia Love. And you write about, I'm not sure which of you guys want to take this on or who wrote this part. They're holding these regular homework sessions in Mia Love's basement. Mm-hmm. How much did she know about national politics, national economic policy? She was a quick study, but she liked visuals more than she liked briefing papers. To tell about that.
Yeah, I mean, it was they were starting with, I don't know how to put this politely, I guess, but she had very little frame of reference for a lot of these issues, and they were kind of trying to get her from 0 to 100 in a very short period of time. They had some difficulty in trying to get her to engage and you know, do her homework, basically.
And there are some questions about her work ethic.
There's a story in the book about how they were going to go down to Southern Utah for a FreedomWorks budget conference, and she was eager to go, and all of her friends were going, and they left her at home and called her from the road and said, "Look, you need to get serious about this, because if you're not, you know, this is you have." You know, another 18 months before the election, and this is going to be your life, and you need to get serious about this. And I guess the consensus was that she received the message, and that and sort of was more focused and more dedicated to her, as they called it, her homework assignments. But yeah, I mean, it was a steep learning curve, and it would be for just about anybody. In fairness, I mean, it's hard for anybody you stop on the street to talk about the complicated, policies in Congress, and at the level that a member, somebody who wants to be a member of Congress needs to know them. But
Dodd-Frank, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think the one thing I found fascinating about her is that she's all in on whatever she's doing, almost to the exclusion of everything else. When she was doing musical theater, she could probably tell you everything about musical theater. But if you asked her about things going on in the world, she'd have no clue what you're talking about. When she was in city government, she could probably tell you everything about zoning you want to know, because they're zoning for fast food places and grocery stores and new developments. That's what she did. And then from that, she became, hey, you want to run for Congress? And
when
sure.
she went full in.
Yeah, she went full right into it. Yeah. And the idea was, well, what do you know about it? And it's like, not very much. You know, you brought up Dodd-Frank. We have a story in there that Chris Dodd is the former senator from Connecticut, her home state, where she lived to her adulthood. She had never heard his name before, you know, and that might be, there's lots of people who don't know that Orrin Hatch or Mike Lee are Utah senators, but you would assume if you're running for Congress that you would be somehow politically aware. And she wasn't. I find that fascinating that for her, these steps just kind of happen. And that's this quick rise. She is just learning as she goes.
And to bring it straight.
That is really the stumble of the book, too. The part of the rise, stumble, and resurgence. The stumble part is the 2012 campaign where she's kind of thrust into this situation. There's really no captain of the ship when it comes to her campaign. There's people flying in from Washington saying, do this. There's people in Utah saying, do this. And it became, you know, some of a mess that had she had, you know, somebody leading from the top, or she was more, you know, politically attuned at the time, who was ready and willing to step into this, you know, fast rise, then she might have beat Matheson in 2012.
But it's interesting, though, did she learn her lesson? I mean, because you get a sense in your reporting that she did, and I'm guessing this is pretty tempting, if you have national money, if people are willing to give national money to you and national attention and national figures are willing to work on your campaign, this question of whether or not a national machine really took over the campaign in 2012 and, for that matter, in 2014. What do you think about that?
Well, it depends, obviously, on who you talk to. The local people think the national people took over. The national people think the local people weren't doing their job and they had to kind of pitch in to help. It's clear, and the money thing is kind of interesting because really up until the national convention, until she sort of got that national profile, they were living hand to mouth. I mean, they were scraping by, you know, people were skipping paychecks and that sort of thing. So did the national machine take over? Well, yeah, the national consultants, the NRCC, played a pretty active role in this campaign. There's no question about that. Why did they do that? Well, partly because the local campaign staff was largely inexperienced. You kind of got to have to put this in the frame of context of, in 2012, we had a gubernatorial race. We had Orrin Hatch, who was running aggressively to defend his Senate seat and hiring everybody up. You had all of these different congressional campaigns. You had other people who were running for the fourth seat who were hiring people. So there weren't a lot of political operatives available to be hired locally. So she had this inexperienced staff of friends and neighbors and that sort of thing, who were sort of venturing down this road for the first time, as was she. And so she leaned heavily on some of these campaign consultants and some of their advice. We've seen this repeatedly in Utah, I think. Sometimes the out-of-state campaigns consultants don't really get the nature of Utah politics. We don't deal well with negative campaigns. We don't deal well with there are certain things that are sort of off limits. And one of the stories that's in there is they cut this ad that they were going to run and they showed the Mormon temple in it out in her neck of the woods. And you know, they had to explain to these national consultants that that's probably not a good idea because it's clearly putting religion in a political context. And there was some back and forth and they eventually ended up cutting it out. But that's the sort of a little bit of tone deafness you get when you deal with sometimes national consultants that like that. So I think in 2014, as Matt mentioned, it was sort of a different ballgame. She had Dave Hansen, who's one of, you know, the most experienced political consultants, political campaign managers in the state, and he kept a very tight control of the ship. And there wasn't anybody to do that, to sort of referee the competing interest.
But how is it that she came so close to losing that race with Doug Owens? I mean, that's only one chapter in the book we should mention. But it is interesting. No one gave Doug Owens a chance early in this. And the question is, why? Why didn't she just run the table with that guy?
You know, I think there's a couple things that happened there. In the 2012 race, Jim Matheson, the incumbent who won re-election against her, this continually pound her as being
an
extremist.
But he was an incumbent. He had tons of money.
Right, but I'm saying what
Owens
he did.
Was nobody at the beginning of this, and he almost won.
But what he did is he followed Jim Matheson's playbook.
Got it.
Matheson continually pound Mia Love as a Tea Party extremist. Yeah. And while the Tea Party is strong in the conservative caucus, Republican caucuses, when you get to a general election, Tea Party doesn't have the clout it had in 2009. And so Matheson just pounded her as an extremist. You're an extremist. She's an extremist. Do you want an extremist? Doug Owens runs, says, hey, I want to do the same thing. That seemed to work. And so everything he did the same thing. And she didn't really counter it strongly.
Dude, let me ask you this. You don't get to this in the book, but I did wonder about this. In a conservative state, mm-hmm. whether they'll tell pollsters this or not, is race a factor to the negative for a character?
Her campaign manager thought it was,
yeah.
in a small degree. We also heard from people who were very excited because she shows that Utah can have, you know, is not just white, that Mormons are not just white, that Republicans are not just white. So there's it had, I think, mixed effect. Her campaign manager said it was a small negative, but insignificant. Really,
and race matters, but the message matters too, and how you couch that race, the race issue. And she has, whenever she talks about race, she talks about bringing people together and pulling yourself up by your bootstraps and not expecting handouts. And that's sort of a way that she has catered her message to sort of counteract any racial concerns or racial resentment that might be out there.
We're about out of time. Tell me, Burr, let me put this question to you as we sort of move forward now on this question of how she's going to perform in the national stage. Because one of the questions you ask early in the book is how she will balance the national attention with the needs of the people back home. I mean, you've got Congressman Jason Chaffetz, you've got Senator Mike Lee, Orrin Hatch for that matter, all of them have national profiles. What kind of a congressperson is she going to be? Are you having any sense of that early on?
You know, I can definitely tell the Washington press corps is interested in her. They all know who she is, as do all the new members of Congress already know who she is. You know, and I staked out her hotel when she first got to town, and there was a news crew already waiting for her, you know, to talk to her. We were doing the office lottery, and there was a news crew outside waiting for her, and another ABC news crew followed her on a little later. I don't think she's trying to embrace the media. She's not shying away from doing national media, but she is very much talking about, you know, every time she does an interview, her Utah constituents, what can I do for Utah? So she gets it. She's aware of it, even if she's going to have to try to fight off the national focus that everyone else wants her to have.
Just quickly, the CNN performance didn't go so well right after the election. Is that an indicator that she's going to still bristle at the question of whether her race had anything to do with her election?
We've talked about this before, that Dave Hansen is a brilliant, you know, campaign manager, but he's not coming to Washington with her. So she's got to surround herself by some smart people who know how to help her with those questions.
It's Tommy Burr, Robert Gerke, Matt Canham. They all co-wrote the book, Mia Love, The Rise, Stumble, and Resurgence of the Next GOP Star. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thanks, Doug.
Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.